Calling State Affairs to order at 3:02 p.m., Thursday, February 2nd, in the Max Grunberg Room. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Story? Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Vance? Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Fields? Representative Price Thompson?
Here. Representative Fields is in a joint hearing that is still going on just down the hallway, but he will pop in when free. Four members present, I have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence any cell phones in the audience. And thank you, Martha and Madison, for facilitating today's meeting. We have three items on the agenda. A first hearing of House Bill 148 relating to marriage witnesses, sponsored by Representative Klayman. A second hearing, SB 144, sponsored by Senator Bishop, establishing Walter Harper Day on June 7. And then a first hearing, a governor's bill, House Bill 225, relating to prostitution and sex trafficking. First up, and this is, I think, a slight reordering from how it was initially noticed, is going to be House Bill 148 from Representative Klayman. Representative Klayman and Ms. Jonas, please come forward, present the legislation, and let the record also reflect Representative Vance joined us at 3:04 p.m.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 148, an act relating to the solemnization of marriage. I'm Representative Matt Klayman. I represent House District 21 in West Anchorage. At present, during the solemnization of marriage, couples must assent to the marriage in the presence of each other, the person solemnizing the marriage, and at least two additional witnesses. Afterward, all parties must sign the marriage certificates. House Bill 148 would eliminate the requirements for any additional witnesses at the marriage solemnization and the signatures of these witnesses on the marriage certificates. These changes will bring our ceremonial requirements into the modern age and help support Alaska's destination wedding industry while preserving the integrity of marriage solemnization. Alaska is one of only 17 states that require two wedding witnesses in addition to the person officiating the marriage. 25 states do not require wedding witnesses. Wedding witnesses played a more critical role in past centuries when record keeping was less automated. In England, prior to the 18th century, the legal requirements of marriage were governed by the canon law of the Church of England. A marriage was considered valid as long as the union was consented to by both parties and celebrated by an Anglican clergyman. This largely informal process that dictated the validity of marriage allowed for a proliferation of clandestine marriages. In 1746, a woman laid claim to the recently deceased Captain John Campbell's pension on the basis that she married him in a clandestine ceremony. The problem arose because another woman claimed that she too was the wife of Captain John Campbell. The confusion that ensued from the inability to verify marriage claims led to Parliament passing the Act for the Betterment of Preventing Clandestine Marriage, commonly known in the common law as the Marriage Act of 1753. The Act formalized the marriage process, requiring that marriages be viewed by witnesses who could later be called on to confirm that the marriage did or did not take place, and placed an extra precaution of record keeping should records of marriage be damaged or go missing. The Marriage Act is the historical basis for the two witness requirement that is the requirement in a minority of states, including Alaska. Today, however, the role of wedding witnesses is almost entirely ceremonial. In Alaska, while the person solemnizing the marriage must meet certain criteria, the law does not require any form of witness verification. No proof of identification, no language comprehension, no address validation, nothing. House Bill 148 will actually allow Alaska to compete more directly with states like Hawaii and Florida, which require no wedding witnesses and lead the nation in destination weddings. Destination weddings, often on mountaintops and glaciers, are a growing business in Alaska. The requirement of two wedding witnesses makes the state less attractive for many couples who travel from far away and do not want the financial burden of a larger wedding, and actually sometimes having to pay for more helicopters to get to their mountaintop site. Couples who come to the state without their own witnesses are tasked with finding strangers to witness their wedding. The burden of supplying these witnesses often falls on those who work in Alaska's wedding industry, who ask friends and family to attend the weddings of their out-of-town clients. In addition to the awkwardness of having strangers witness the wedding, the additional witness requirement can place an increased financial burden on the couple. For example, in a wedding in a remote location like a glacier via a helicopter, they must pay extra seating costs to transport the witnesses. At present, destination weddings bring in an estimated $1 million in revenue to the state in the form of roughly 500 destination weddings a year. This year, this revenue figure doesn't consider the fact that more than 90% of the out-of-state couples who come to Alaska to get married stay for days and weeks to explore our great state. The resulting benefit to Alaska's tourism industry is substantial. House Bill 148 would simplify the wedding process by reducing the number of hurdles a couple must address to get married. And I will now have my staff, Sophie Jonas, present a sectional and analysis of the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Sophie Jonas, and I am staff to Representative Matt Klayman. Section 1 of House Bill 148 amends Alaska Statute 25-5301 by eliminating the requirement of two witnesses at a marriage solemnization. Section 2 of House Bill 148 amends Alaska Statute 250532 by eliminating the requirement of the signatures of two witnesses on marriage certificates. Section 3 of House Bill 148 amends Alaska Statute 2505361 by deleting language to conform with changes made in Section 1 of this bill. Section 4 of the bill repeals Alaska Statute 2505-41A3 and Alaska Statute 2505-41A5 to conform with changes made in Section 1 of this bill. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to present, and at this time, we are happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you for the bill presentation. Fascinating. Solemnization is kind of a favorite subject of state affairs over the last couple of years. Representative Klayman, you're sort of the ace in the hole on the subject. Questions from the committee? Representative Hopkins?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just went through this and could have used the not having to go find two witnesses. Fortunately, we had some. We had a big enough wedding that we had plenty of people around. A quick question. With the, this is not related to your bill, but the on line one page, or sorry, page one, line eight, where it says that they take each other to be husband and wife with the, I'm not introducing an amendment to deal with this, with the allowance for same-sex marriages, is that still general standard language in our statute for keeping husband and wife as opposed to the married couple or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I don't want to claim to have read every page of all the statutes. For lack of the best answer I can give you is that I think if we, since the federal courts have ruled that the constitutional amendment regarding marriage was unconstitutional, I think if we were to try to change every place in the statutes to comply with that order, we would spend a lot of time not looking at the budget.
That's a fair answer.
And we might not be able to reach resolution within the legislature.
I also agree with that. Thank you.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. I guess I'm going to have to go back home and actually take this to my wife and try to remember what we had to do for all of the wedding certificate and complications of trying to get that paperwork right, because it was incredibly complicated. And we did not – the person solemnizing the marriage, the officiant, did not have to actually sign anything at all to become the officiant. We had to just submit his name to the courthouse up in Fairbanks and to Vital Records. So that was interesting, but and then having to sign it. So I'm going to support this bill. I like the idea of not having to sign the wedding certificate, so making eloping and shotgun weddings much easier, which was something we certainly debated. we didn't, and we should have. But, yeah, I want to take this back home and see what she remembers from how many things we had to sign and see if we can make it even easier, because I certainly agree with the bill in trying to make the process easier, because it was weeks of planning ahead of time for the wedding that we had to go through to get the paperwork done in time, because it's a very slow, drawn-out process that seemed very difficult for people in rural Alaska to go quickly get their wedding if they wanted. It was sending it to Vital Statistics and back and forth and a bit of a bit of complication, so I'll certainly bring this back and see if there's any way we can make it even easier within the small changes that you have here. But thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Story.
Thank you. I was wondering if the states that have already done this, just require one witness, if they have had any concerns or if anything's come up with not having more than one witness.
25 states require no witnesses, so we would be joining, or more than 25 states, so we'd be joining the majority of the states. In our research, we did not find any states describing any problems with it, and we have invited testimony from primarily photographers in the wedding industry that will tell you a lot more about kind of how this plays out in the real world.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Vance, it looks like you want to ask a question, but you haven't raised your hand.
I don't know if I want to ask a question, but so with the states who have no requirement for witnesses, have they seen an increase in the rate of marriage? In the rate of marriage.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't know. What I do know, which as we heard, we learned about this from wedding photographers that contacted my office, and what we do know is that Hawaii leads the nation in destination weddings, and they don't have a witness requirement. That's all I can say. I think that, and what the wedding photographers and the people that brought this bill to my office are saying is that the business that they are in, they will do a much better job of serving their clients if they don't have to recruit two witnesses.
Follow up. I understand the need to increase commerce and ease that burden, but marriage is still one of the more hopeful, hopefully it's still more one of the more respected unions, and it is a very legal process. And I think simply trying to ease the burden of commerce is something that I struggle with in removing the two witnesses, because I haven't heard of people choosing to not get married because of the burden of two witnesses. That seems like, I mean, when I got married, we had to have our witnesses, and I don't remember it being a big deal. You know, picking out my dress was a bigger deal. You know what I mean? Like, there's other things. Now, I understand that Alaska wants to increase its destination point, but I think I would like to see stronger data of the overall burden that two witnesses provides.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I think that what brought this bill to our attention was the interests of commerce, but the real issue about this is what serve in as a matter of law and procedure, what purpose does the wedding witnesses serve? And when you look back to the Marriage Act of 1753 in England, which is the foundation of why we have witness requirements in the United States and other places, in some states, was because of the problem with clandestine marriages that were going on in England in the 1700s, when there was no way to actually provide proof and there was no central record-keeping authority. And so the question I asked was not, does the witnesses provide a security that the marriage actually occurred and proof of that? What does that offer for actual proof that the marriage occurred? And the answer I came up with is that under our current record-keeping requirements, where we have a State Department of Vital Statistics and a very detailed record-keeping requirement, the question that comes up if somebody did they or did they not get married is there a certificate filed in Department of Vital Statistics? The need for witnesses arose in England because marriages were controlled by the Church of England, and you'd have different people claiming to have been married, and so the witnesses provided some authentication for somebody to say, I really got married. Today, if you say, did I really get married, no one looks for the witnesses. They go down to Vital Statistics and say, is there a document to say it happened? And I will actually tell you that I once had a case, not in Alaska, but the question arose whether somebody who claimed to have a pension related to someone who had died, whether they had been previously married, in another jurisdiction. And we actually went to the other jurisdiction and did not go looking for witnesses. We actually looked for court records in the vital statistics area to see whether or not either had they been married, and if they had been married, was that whether there was record of the divorce. And in fact, we found both the marriage and the divorce, but we never looked past the Bureau of Vital Statistics in that jurisdiction. So my answer to you about what purpose do the wedding witnesses serve, which were originally for the purpose of proving the validity of the marriage, they do not serve that purpose anymore today, and haven't for decades.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was a little concerned about, you know, if you have a under the legal age marriage going to take place, is there any way they have to have a certification from the parents, or is it just a signature on the form?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, we actually had a bill a couple of years ago to try to raise the marriage age, and there was surprising opposition from a diversity of people here in the legislature. And what I learned from that was, I believe the proof of age is part of getting the license and not the witnessing side, so that when you go down to the courthouse to get your marriage license, the proof of age, the minimum age, which I think is now 16, is something that the courthouse requires before they give you the license. And so, again, the witness requirements don't do anything to address the age requirements.
So somebody 15 getting married, how did we go about this with the parent permission?
I would believe that a parent would have to go down to the courthouse and they'd have to show, okay, so this person's 15 years old and the parents are consenting the marriage, and if the parents weren't there and they didn't have proof of proof of parentage, then they wouldn't issue the marriage certificate. One has to assume that people are honest when they do these things. If somebody goes down to the courthouse with fraudulent IDs and whatnot, some point, we can only do so much on that count.
True. Thank you.
Representative Thompson, for the record, I remember when the bill increasing the legal age of marriage came through this committee, and there was quite a bit of opposition, as I recall. Representative Hopkins, did you have a question?
I was remembering back to recently doing this and wanted to quickly correct something I said on the record. I do not wish that we had eloped. I loved our wedding and it was wonderful. So it's corrected on the record now. But when it did come down to the sanctity of the situation and the ceremony that we had, trying to make sure that we had the forms all correct afterwards, getting them signed, making sure we had the correct paperwork, and getting it back to vital statistics, there are no more vital statistics in Fairbanks and only in Anchorage, so we do have to mail it immediately after the wedding. Having to make sure we had additional signers there, making sure we had all the paperwork in place, there was still a fair bit of legal work we had to do, but making sure we jumped through those additional hoops made it less romantic and less feeling of sanctified. It was worse having to just get more people to sign on, making sure we had multiple copies available, making sure we had them in duplicate and the right address in the forms that the division or that the courthouse gave us. It was not great having the additional witnesses there and giving us less time together right after the wedding. So just in a romantic aspect, I support this bill and appreciate the work being done. That was our least favorite part of our wedding.
What? I think Rep. Shaw's first.
Oh, what, Representative Shaw, first comment of 2020.
Thank you, Chairman Christ Tompkins. I was married many years, probably before you were born, and I never lost an ounce of romance anywhere along the paperwork trail. It stayed with me from start until today. And I remember my wife was born and raised in Anchorage. We got married in Texas. She was surprised after 5 years of knowing one another, dating, that we were going to get married. So we finally did. We took the paperwork with us. We had witnesses. We moved them forward. It took us about 12 minutes. It was a non-event. Filed them with vital statistics. And to this day, I still have romance.
All right, I'm going to refocus the committee discussion. Any other questions, perhaps, on the letter of the bill? Representative Vance?
I could have some not quite as exciting stories, but I'm trying to rephrase this as a question. I'll look this way.
You look at Shelby.
So, in the legality of marriage, I'm still struggling to see the burden of two witnesses, because when it comes to the legality and witnesses on our permanent fund dividend application, we have to provide two witnesses that verify our residency and intent to remain as residents. So what's the difference in the burden of proof here, or the burden on providing two witnesses?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe if you look at the history of the requirements for the permanent fund verification, there is a history and a fairly substantial history of fraud in connection with permanent fund applications. And every year there are prosecutions. Maybe it's tailed off, but in the early years there were a lot of prosecutions about people fraudulently filing for permanent fund applications. I'm not aware of any cases in Alaska in which somebody claims to have been married and somebody and that where that fraudulent issue has arisen. I'm not phrasing it properly, I don't think, but there's a very different deal because the permanent fund is about an appropriation from the state, and if you actually take that permanent fund or you apply and get one, that's a form of theft from the state. And I think that's the reason why there's that verification requirement. And I think, again, there has not been a single case in which the witness has become important to whether or not the marriage actually occurred.
I think at this time I'm going to move to invited testimony, and there are three people online, perhaps a fourth, Drew Connolly from Chugach Peaks Photography, is listed available for questions. Mr. Connolly, if that's incorrectly.
I think he has testimony.
I think he's got testimony. Okay, so I'm going to set the limit of invited testimony at 2.5 minutes for time conservation. First, we'll start with Reverend Mulhern in Wasilla. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2.5 minutes or less.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Mr. Chair and distinguished representatives, my name is Reverend Kean Cole Mulhern. I'm an ordained minister from Wasilla, and I represent Celtic Ministries. I have been a minister and performed weddings for over 21 years, traveled to many of the states that you all have been discussing that do not have witnesses. It is a huge burden for us to find people to travel with us to witness these weddings. So many a times I leave Wasilla, I go clear down to Girdwood or Whittier to do a wedding, having to take two witnesses with me for a 30-minute ceremony. That's a lot of time out of the witnesses' days to do this. I do approximately 150 weddings a year. Over 90% of those are destination weddings here in Alaska. These couples are coming from all over the world, not just the lower 48. And most of the couples come here for a very small, intimate elopement. And then they spend lots of time here honeymooning in the state. They don't know anybody here, so it leaves the burden up to me or another person in the wedding industry to find these witnesses for them. Also, most couples aren't thrilled to have two people that they have never met as part of their very special day. and find it just a little intrusive. It's not like your invitation to a regular wedding. The other large part of weddings that I perform are from servicemen and women from J. Bear and Fort Wainwright. These couples also many a times are new to Alaska, and they don't really have any friends yet, nor do they know even their neighbors. These witnesses are not being used to verify who these couples are or check IDs. In fact, that is what the Bureau of Vital Statistics does when the couple applies for the marriage license and picks it up. That's why their licenses are attached to the paperwork. The witnesses are also not called on to verify the wedding or that the wedding was performed in the proper manner. That would be one thing, but there is no way, even with these witnesses, that from their signature and address on the piece of paper that you could verify. As somebody was talking about with the PFD, those are people that the person from applying for the PFD actually knows.
And Reverend Mulhern, I'm gonna we're a little over 2.5 minutes, so I have a quick question. Okay. For these destination weddings, are you the solemnizer for these couples?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee for Reverend Mulhern? Seeing none, thank you for taking the time to testify today. Next in the queue, Erica Rose of Anchorage. Erica, please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2.5 minutes or less.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you everyone so much for taking the time to hear our testimony in regards to Bill 148. My name is Erica Rose. I'm a wedding photographer based in Anchorage. I've been doing this work for about 10 years and shoot approximately 40 weddings each year. Many of them are small elopements for people who come in from out of state. I know from talking with dozens of other wedding professionals that hundreds of couples come here each year to get married. One of the best things about my job is the privilege of being part of a very sacred moment in people's lives. And while this is a business for me, I do take seriously the gravity of the events taking place. I learned through this work that this state is incredibly desirable for people to come and have their weddings here. And I believe that there's still potential for more growth in this area. A big trend right now is for weddings in adventure and mountain locations, which we are perfect for. It's also clear that very many other businesses outside of the wedding industry benefit from this. Most couples I work with ask for recommendations about where to stay, what tours they can take, you know, things like that. And much of the time when people choose to elope, it's not necessarily to save money, but it's because they have a different value when it comes to money. So they'd rather take that budget and spend it on their experiences. The two-witness rule is just a really big hurdle for us a lot of the time because, firstly, people choose to elope and they want it to be private for a reason. There's a variety of reasons that people might have for this, but they just don't want extra people to be around, so they kind of go out of their way to be in kind of an intimate setting. And a lot of the time when people want to elope, they want it to be in a really stunningly beautiful location, and a lot of times it can be difficult to figure out how to get two extra people out there, whether it's cost prohibitive, having to bring an extra or a larger helicopter to fly out extra people, or, you know, things of that nature. One time I had a couple up here from Tennessee. They wanted to get married in a remote area of Hatcher Pass, but we couldn't bank on a hiker being out there who could act as a witness. So we had to wait in a parking lot, and the next hiker that came along, I kind of politely asked him, hey, would you mind just being here for 20 minutes and watching this wedding real quick? They would really appreciate it. And he was great. He was willing to do it, but it definitely just detracts from the day. I think that every wedding professional has stories like this, and I could tell you more if I wasn't on a 2-minute time limit. But the main goal for us as wedding professionals is to make this big, huge day in our clients' lives as special as possible, and to provide incredible service. And so while these types of stories do sound kind of funny now, in the moment they do feel like small failures to provide that service. So thank you all again for taking the time to hear from a few of us. I know that we do represent many businesses across the state, and we do take very seriously the fact that these are marriages that, you know, are big moments, but also legal and take a lot of thought for the people involved. So thank you for consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Rose, for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? I have a question. Is elopement a term that is a wedding industry term? Is that like a category of, I mean, I know what eloping is, but the term elopement has now been used several times.
Yeah. It's kind of a big trend right now. Elopement, it's not necessarily a term maybe that we just use, but we would define a wedding that's small, you know, just the bride and groom kind of going off to do their own private wedding as an elopement.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, next in the queue, Erin Vellander in Anchorage. Ms. Vellander, please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2.5 minutes or less.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Mr. Chair, distinguished representatives, I appreciate that you are hearing this bill today as it impacts so many businesses and small business owners. I think the points I would like to make, what my fellow colleagues brought up about the impact on our economy, the impact on their businesses, are all great. So as opposed to further discussing those points, I want to make 2 points. The first is that I've been doing this for about 20 years, and I facilitate adventure weddings. So I'm an adventure wedding planner. I help couples who come up to Alaska elope, where it's just the two of them, and we do these in pretty extreme places. So we fly out on helicopters a lot. We hike in the mountains. I also do this in Hawaii, and I will tell you that after doing hundreds and hundreds of these, it does deter people from coming to Alaska, and you will see that in the data if you look at how many people elope in Hawaii as opposed to Alaska. So I think the data is probably there if you did some digging. The other point that I want to make is, you know, I used to plan very large weddings for a living. And I can tell you that whether there's 500 people at a wedding witnessing it or no people at a wedding witnessing it, that does not determine the sacredness of that moment. So I know that there was an argument brought up where the two witnesses make it sacred and marriage is one of the last things that is sacred. I don't think it's anyone's decision or in anyone's power to tell couples how they choose to get married. So I can tell you that through my experience, many times when it's these very small weddings where it's just two people, someone marrying them, that feels more sacred a lot of times than these weddings where they're a huge production and there's 500 people looking at them, and some of that has gotten lost. So I guess I would just implore you, when you're considering this, the two witnesses that are oftentimes strangers for people who are coming up here to elope, do not make that any more sacred. In fact, a lot of times it feels like they make it less sacred because they are strangers. And these people are choosing to get married the way that they want to get married, which is just the two of them. And so I don't think that we necessarily have the right to say that that's not okay. So that's why I support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Vellander, for the testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, last in the queue is Joe Connolly in Anchorage. Mr. Connolly, thanks for taking the time to testify. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2.5 minutes or less.
Hi, Evan. My name is Joe Connolly, and I am with Chugach Peaks Photography. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this bill. If I cannot count towards my 2.5 minutes, do you want me to give you the definition for elopement? I did look that up for you.
We would love the definition of elopement.
Okay. I've got it here for you. So elopement is, to elope most literally means to run away and not to come back to the point of origin, which most people usually go back to the point of origin, but Elopement is often used to refer to a marriage conducted in sudden and secretive fashion, usually involving in a hurried flight away from one's place of residence together with one's beloved with the intention of getting married. In most cases, it is less sudden, but equally private and small. So there's the definition of elopement. So I understand there's a lot of really pressing bills and matters that you guys all have to consider with state budgets and crime issues, and this might sound like a strange bill to be hearing about, but really the economic impact that weddings have on the state is probably more significant than you might expect. Requiring two witnesses to be present is an unfair burden and an awkward intrusion into what these people intended originally as a private and personal event. You know, the very act of eloping is to get away from it all and have a small wedding with no family and friends present. And for those of us who had a big wedding, which I did with family and friends, it might sound odd to want to do that, but I can assure you that there are a lot of folks that don't want to have a big fancy wedding with a bunch of guests. And as mentioned in the briefing provided previously and from the other testimony from the other folks that you heard from, hundreds and hundreds of couples from the lower 48 and really the world now come to Alaska every year to get married in one of the last truly free and wild places in the United States. And these people are coming up, just the two of them, alone with no family, no friends. They don't live in Alaska. They don't know anyone in Alaska. And, you know, social media, the increase in tourism infrastructure and marketing within the state have all helped pull people to the state of Alaska. Even the silly Discovery Channel TV shows bring people in, believe it or not. And 100% of these folks who call looking to do a wedding like this, 100% want to get married either on a glacier, on a rocky beach next to the ocean, in a flowery meadow, next to a waterfall. They want to have the mountains and the glaciers behind them. And at no point do they say to us when they're talking to us, hey, by the way, would you mind bringing a few random people with you to witness our wedding? We'd love to have just some random people just hanging out with us. You know, they want to get married in a quiet place alone, and they want to have a serious, intimate moment with no other folks around watching them. We get a lot of people that want to get married on a glacier and fly in with a helicopter, and due to the fact that most of the helicopters we work with can only seat three people plus the pilot, this means that they have to pay for an extra seat or an extra helicopter, even if the pilot marries them and the photographer is a witness. And then they have to pay, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dollars more. And you'd think that this might actually be a good thing for the helicopter company, but it really isn't, because a lot of the people are actually turned off by the idea altogether once we tell them it's going to cost twice as much, because now they need to fly witnesses out. So instead of increasing business for the helicopter companies, they're actually losing business. And it's really frustrating to have someone excited about an idea and then have them back away because the cost just doubled due to some ancient state law that is probably not relevant anymore. And if it's, you know, if it's not a helicopter, it might be a hike to the top of a mountain like Eric was talking about, Hatcher Pass. We do stuff in the Hatcher Pass, Turnagain Pass, all over. And we get a lot of people that want to do that. But they have to bring a witness to make it official and legal. And so we're tasked with finding a family member or a friend who has to give off or give up 2 hours of their day to drive to Hatcher Pass, hike up for an hour. They hang out up there for 20 minutes, and then they have to drive down again, and then, or hike down again, drive down again. They just basically give up a day for 20 minutes. And, you know, how do you justify that? It's pretty silly, and, you know, we've only got so many nice summer days, and most people don't want to give those up. The economic impact of these weddings far exceeds the direct benefits to the vendors like us in the wedding industry. A wedding is more than just an officiant, photographer, wedding planner, florist, the hair and makeup artist, etc. These are the folks that directly make their living off of elopements and destination weddings. But additionally, when an eloping couple comes to Alaska, they usually stay for at least 7 to 10 days. They get a car, they get a hotel room, they eat at restaurants, they go grocery shopping, they book a whale watching tour, they do a glacier cruise in Whittier or Seward, they go dog mushing with some Iditarod musher who's trying to keep his kennel afloat during the summer.
Mr. Connell, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your testimony if you can.
All right, so this bill would put Alaska into a more competitive place within the destination wedding market, like Hawaii, Nevada, and Florida. And again, none of those places have a witness requirement. We'd love to see you guys consider this and pass it. I think it'd have a really big impact, not on just us, but tourism as a whole within the state of Alaska. I appreciate you guys taking the time. Thanks.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, I'm going to set this bill aside. This has been 42 minutes. Good issue, but also a good amount of time. And I'm going to set an amendment deadline of 5 p.m. Monday, February 24th. If anybody has any amendments, note Representative Hopkins. And I think this is scheduled for next Tuesday, and so we'll look to the will of the committee at that point to potentially discharge the bill, if that is the will. Thank you, Representative Clayman and Ms. Jonas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next piece of legislation is Senate Bill 144, Walter Harper Day is June 7th. This is the second hearing. We heard of this first on Tuesday this week. There were no amendments submitted by the amendment deadline. Public testimony is noticed today, and there is a bit of testimony. I'm going to set a 2.5-minute limit for public testimony as well, and at this time I'm going to open testimony. First in the queue is Mike Harper in Anchorage. Mr. Harper, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Harper, family of Walter Harper. I am grandnephew of Walter, and I am one of probably at least 30 first cousins that I know of in the Harper family that all are very appreciative of the legislature's effort to mark June 7th as Walter Harper Day. So we're here certainly in support of that. I think you had great testimony the other day, a presentation from the Senator Bishop and his staff. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer those, but we are proud of this effort to honor Walter, and hope that we can answer questions and this becomes law. So I know there's some other people online, and if you have questions to me, I'm here to answer those, or go to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. Any questions from the committee? Oh. Representative Story.
Just a comment, Mr. Walker. If you were ever in Juneau, I would really enjoy talking to you. This is Rep. Story, and I live in Juneau, and room 403 in the Capitol. I'd like to know more of your history and your family recollections about Walter. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Be happy to do that.
Sorry, Mr. Harper.
Thank you, Representative Shaw.
Next in the queue is Bill Gordon in Fairbanks. Mr. Gordon, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is Bill Gordon. I'm from Fairbanks, a lifelong Alaskan here. I know you've got plenty of information before you in the sponsor statement and supporting documents, and also the wonderful biography that was written by Mary Erlander is a great source for information, so I won't get into that. I'd just like to give you a little personal tidbit about Harper and his impact on Alaska. My dad, who for decades flew his airplane into Alaska's villages as the Episcopal bishop up here, often took me with him, and sometimes voluntarily and sometimes not. But one of those destinations was to Fort Yukon to visit what was then an Episcopal hospital there, where Walter Harper had been a patient. It was there that my dad, in fact, that's where Walter Harper wanted to return after medical school to do his work as a doctor. It was there my dad kind of told me the story of Harper and the Episcopal Archdeacon Stuck, who they became friends and mentors and benefactors to each other. And my father was very moved by that, and he expressed to me, reminded me of that story and how important it was to Alaska's history. Harper should be recognized, therefore, for much more than just his ascent of the mountain, which is exceptional in his own right. But he was a kind of a gift to early Alaska's relationship between the native peoples and those who would come later. Even at a time when Alaska discrimination was rampant in our territory, the two of them, Stuck and Harper, really gave us a blueprint that for future generations to follow, that still serves this state well. Some of us testifying today are also working to design and finance a statue to be placed in honoring Harper and the other Alaskans who accompanied the ascent of Denali South Peak. There's far too little recognition of important moments in our state, and we need special days and statues to tell these stories, not only to visitors but to remind those of us that are already here of who paved our way. We're going to strive to get that statue up over the next year. It is our hope that that statue can be dedicated on Walter Harper Day in 2021. And with your help supporting Senate Bill 144, we can accomplish that goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, next in the queue is Catherine Tritt in Fairbanks. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hello, this is Kathy Tritt. I'm a Athabaskan native, Gwich'in, and I'm calling from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm calling for my relative elder, John Fritzen, and I just want to know why he is not getting recognized on this one. There's Walter Harper, and there's also Harry Kirstens and Robert Tandem, and I just want Tandem. And I just want to know where John Fritzen is. You know, he's one of the people that helped them go up to the mountain with Denali. And where I only see three recognized people here, and also John Fritzen, and there's Isaias George that was there too, and they're the ones that helped them go up. So what can we do about that?
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Tritt. I might refer you to the sponsor's office for that dialogue. That's Senator Bishop's office, and I'm sure they could speak more to the question. Next in the queue is Jude Hensler in Fairbanks. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, my name is Jude Hensler, and I want to, maybe everybody knows this, but three young Alaska Native men were involved in the first ascent climb, and they were part of the party. Walter Harper, John Fritzen, and Isaias George. And we know Isaias George died young, probably in the flu epidemic. And we know that Walter Harper died young, drowned in the Santa Sofia drowning, and but John Fredson lived. He was the first graduate. Perhaps this is not for sure, not factual, but he was a student at Suwannee, the University of the South, it's an Episcopal Church, or Episcopal University, and he was probably the first full-blooded Native graduate, Alaska Native graduate. And his biggest accomplishment was the author and the creator of the Venati Arctic Village 1.4 million acre Indian reservation, which is still within the ownership of the people of Venati and Arctic Village. He was the informant for the famous linguist Edward Sapir, or the Tinchishu Gwich'in language. He is the author of the book Gogwanduk, which is 52 Indian stories. He's the subject of a biography, Jo Gwatsun, which is the wolf smeller. And in addition to that, he's the father of Lou Young, the first wife of Congressman Don Young. And so he lived, and those are his accomplishments. And I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, But if there can only be a Walter Harbor Day, so be it. But it seems to me it'd be more appropriate and better and something that's more inclusive if you could figure the two other young men in that. That's my testimony. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Hensler. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Jennifer Henslar and Chugiak, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Jennifer Henslar. I am daughter of Jude and Grace Henslar. My mother's maiden name is Grace George. As you heard, she is the niece of Isaias George, who was one of the two young Native boys, along with John Fredson, who assisted in the first successful ascent of Denali. And I have to say, I fully support this bill, honoring Walter Harbor and his amazing accomplishment, especially as an Alaskan Native growing up in Fairbanks and Anchorage, with a serious dearth of Native heroes and heroines taught in public school and in the public view. I say this day would go a long way in alleviating this issue. I would also be remiss in not acknowledging John Fredson's accomplishments in becoming the first Alaska Native to graduate from college. And I know this is Walter Harper's day, and I think, like I said, it's going to go a long way into helping all of us in Alaska recognizing what he did. But I also think that, as my father stated, that these other Native boys should be recognized also. And I can't say what Isaias George or Walter Harper, what they have accomplished since they both were struck down so young. But, I think this is a step in the right direction and fully support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hensler, for your testimony. Seeing no questions from the committee, next in the queue, Mary Erlander. Ms. Erlander, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Great, thank you. So my name is Mary Frank Erlander. I'm an almost lifelong Alaskan, having grown up in Fairbanks. We recently relocated to Olympia for medical reasons. I wrote Walter Harper's biography, so I'm sure it doesn't surprise you that I favor this resolution. And I'm really grateful to Senator Bishop for introducing it. And my central reason is the value that will come from honoring Harper in this way. Being the first person to summit Denali was just a part of what made Walter Harper so noteworthy. His ability to achieve that feat and to contribute so centrally to the success of the expedition owed to the complement of skills and character traits that made him the great Alaskan he was. Walter's superb subsistence skills, developed as a youngster and honed during his years on the trail and river with Episcopal Archdeacon Hudson Stuck, along with his stellar character and his remarkable ability to navigate comfortably in both his Athabascan birth culture and mainstream Western society, won him admirers from all walks of life. His capacities and qualities, especially his strong sense of identity and purpose, are equally admirable today. So designating June 7th, the 1913 Summit Day, as Walter Harper Day, will ensure that Alaskans will know of this great young man. And perhaps most importantly, it will mean that young people will learn of him and many will see him as a hero. And having strong role models can make all the difference for young people as they find their way in life. One can hardly imagine a more appropriate hero and role model for a young Alaskan than Walter Harper. So I urge you to consider the value that could come from designating June 7 as Walter Harper Day. And I would just add, response to some of the other testimony here today, I agree that we need a lot more history about admirable and heroic Alaska Natives and people whom young Alaskans can look up to. And so the people in support of this measure, as well as those who are supporting the construction of the statue, don't mean to take away from other people who also are deserving of recognition. But Walter Harper really is a standout character who can serve as such a great role model, and for good reason. And so we strongly support this. And by the way, the statute will clarify the role of all of the participants in the expedition. And my biography also too clearly lays out the contributions of every team member. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erlander, for your testimony. Representative Fields, do you have a question?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank Ms. Erlander for writing that book. I'm two-thirds of the way through it. Thanks to Senator Bishop for giving it to me, and it's such a fantastic book. So thank you for writing it and for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Erlander? I'd like to second Representative Fields' compliments and all your contributions, Ms. Erlander. That concludes public testimony online. Is there anybody in the room to testify in Senate Bill 144? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Any further comment from the sponsor's office? Seeing none. Representative Shaw.
If I could comment on the bill itself. I flew into the Kahiltna Glacier in 1998, and I spent 3 weeks on the mountain. And I know how difficult it was to spend 5 days in a tent at 40 miles an hour of wind and 20 below temperatures. To think that Walter Harper led an expedition from the valleys of Talkeetna all the way to the top. And that mountain is literally the highest mountain on Earth from base to summit. I was at 18,000 feet at the Everest Base Camp here recently, about 2 years ago. There was no snow at 18,000 feet, and there's only 11,000 more feet to the summit. These guys literally, in packing, what they did, they moved 60,000 feet. And if you went straight from the base of where they started to the top, they literally did about 18,000 feet of elevation gain in one fell sweep. I had the opportunity to visit with Brad Washburn, who literally mapped Denali at Boston College. And he has a tribute to Walter Harper and everybody that supported that event. And the reason, a big reason that we're going to consider this Walter Harper Day on behalf of the sponsor is that all efforts in mountaineering are team efforts. And generally, the recognition is given to the first to summit. And Walter Harper was the first man to summit this mountain ever. And so the recognition to Walter Harper is definitely takes nothing away from the team that supported him. And as it was noted, all of those individuals from a historical perspective and in the biography and on the statue will be noted. But I'm pretty excited about seeing this, having been part of that mountain. So thank you.
Further comments from the committee? Thank you, Representative Shaw. That sounds right to me. This is a remarkable individual. A motion, Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee report out SB 144-31-LS1221/M from committee with attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 144 moves from State Affairs. Take a brief at ease while we rearrange or get the paperwork signed. Coming back on the record, we just discharged SB 144. I also want to post facto make note that Representative Story joined us at 3:05 and Representative Fields joined us at 3:56, although he has since departed, hopscotching committee hearings. The third item on today's agenda, HB 225, relating to prostitution and sex trafficking. It's a governor's bill. Welcome, Mr. Skidmore. This is the first hearing. Please present the legislation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of House State Affairs. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I've been with the division now for about 21 years, and I've served throughout the state in Dillingham, Bethel, Anchorage, and special prosecutions before I'd become the director. I wanted to thank both the chair and the committee for allowing me to present today and to come and talk with you about an issue that our state doesn't get as much attention in our state as it really should, and that's human trafficking and sex trafficking. The issues related to this, I was looking online right before I came to the hearing today, and I found just several hours ago, the USA Today posted an article where it talked about Airbnb and its work to address human trafficking and sex trafficking that's occurring in its facilities. NPR this morning just ran an article about a victim of sex trafficking back on the East Coast, and I'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. But just to kind of place it into context, when we talk about the issues of human trafficking, that's forced labor, there are over 1 million people every year that it's believed are forced into labor trafficking or human trafficking, and there are 25 million currently that are victims of that globally. And that's what the USA Today had indicated in their article that they published just today talking about Airbnb. It's also noted that there are approximately 20 to 50,000 individuals in the United States that are victims of this, and that the United States, according to Britannica, is one of the most significant destinations for victims of sex trafficking. Sex trafficking is the third most profitable business for organized crimes, following only behind drug trafficking and arms trades. It's a $32 billion a year. Stop and think about that. $32 billion a year that organized crime is making off of human trafficking and sex trafficking. That's the type of problem that we're seeing that first began to get noticed back in the 1990s. And there's federal statutes that address this, and there are a number of other states that have begun to try and adjust their laws to be in line with what the federal government has done and to try and ensure that we're able to appropriately respond to these issues. But this is not just an issue that is around the country, though for sex trafficking, I note that the USA Today, back in January 30th of 2018, said that every year there are 10,000 minors that become victims of sex trafficking in the United States. 10,000 a year that are minors. There was a study back in 2016 from the Center for Court Innovation, and they found that for victims between the ages of 13 and 17, victims of sex trafficking, they found in 2016, numbered between 8,900 and 10,500. So the idea that I want to make sure the committee gets from all of this is that there are some folks that say, you know, sex trafficking, human trafficking, that's not such a big problem in Alaska or in the country. And those people just haven't looked at the facts. This is a tremendous problem throughout the country. For Alaska itself, I sit on the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and I asked them to look at some of the numbers for the folks in our shelters, women's shelters around the state, and to ask how many are associated with sex trafficking or human trafficking. The numbers between 2016 and 2019 increased by 115%. The number of victims in the shelters that were reporting being victims of this type of crime increased by 115%. Now, the numbers aren't large. The numbers in 2019 were only at about 42 people. But the more and more people are coming forward and talking about this. The Alaska Native Justice Center in 2018 worked with 126 victims in just that 1 year. 126 victims. Priceless, an organization that tries to work with survivors of human and sex trafficking, found that their victims, their survivors, they've had 150 victims, survivors of sex trafficking that they've worked with, currently 16 that are in shelter right now today. The idea is that this is an issue that is impacting our state, and we need to make sure that we're able to respond to it appropriately. The bill that's in front of you is one that is designed to do two primary things: to bring us closer in line with what the federal government looks at and how they classify human trafficking and sex trafficking, as well as what other states are doing. And we're looking for best practices, not only bringing ourselves more in line with what some others are doing, but we're also looking at best practices for how we can respond to this. Now, the bill that's in front of you is just one piece of the puzzle. I don't want you to walk away from this hearing and thinking, well, we passed that legislation and Mr. Skidmore thinks that's going to solve all the problems. It's not. I've talked with the Anchorage Police Department chief. They are dedicating a detective to be looking at these issues. I've been working with the Department of Public Safety. They are dedicating resources to these issues. The Department of Law is dedicating prosecutors to focus on these issues as well. What we're asking for from you all is your help, to ensure that those law enforcement officers and those prosecutors have the tools that they need that are necessary to be able to participate in this fight in an effective manner. Right now, most of the cases in our state that were of this type were all referred to the FBI and went to the U.S. government because there was a belief amongst law enforcement that our statutes didn't provide us the appropriate tools in terms of penalties or elements. So it's with that backdrop that I ask you to consider this bill. And with that, unless there are any questions, I'm going to turn to the sectional and walk you through it.
Yeah. I think maybe go to the sectional now, and if there's questions during the sectional, maybe we can stop as we go.
Absolutely. I'm happy to answer any questions as they come up. So if you turn to the bill, HB 225, we'll start with Section 1. Section 1 is really just a conforming amendment. And as I talked with some folks in the building about this section, I had some people say, wait a minute, this is a particular statute or a section that deals with the Alcohol Control Board. Are we somehow authorizing the Alcohol Control Board to be involved in investigation of sex trafficking? My answer to that is no. This is simply a conforming amendment. This is authority that was already in law. And because what we do in the bill is we take the sex trafficking provisions and we move them from 1166 to 1141, all the bill does is it indicates that change. It reflects that change. This is conforming and nothing more. Whether or not these investigators actually need to be involved in those investigations, that's a policy decision that we didn't get into. But I just point out it's that sort of a conforming amendment, and I didn't want there to be confusion about what was actually happening there. Section 2 then really starts to get us to part of the heart of the bill. It creates a somewhat new framework. We borrow some of the concepts that's currently in law, but we adjust a few things. And we move the sections, the statutes that deal with sex trafficking from 1166 to 1141. The reason for that is that in our statutes, 1141 is traditionally where we group all of the statutes that are crimes against persons. And so it makes sense for a victim of sex trafficking, that's a crime against a person, to be grouped in the 1141 series. And that's why we move it there. Having moved it there, we do a number of things. Sex trafficking in the first degree focuses on those people that are forced to engage in sex trafficking through force because they are under the age of 20, which is also in current law, or that the person is the legal guardian of the individual that they're forcing into sex trafficking. All three of those first provisions in sex trafficking in the first degree are found in current law. We're not really changing the law in any way. We're just moving the location of it as far as those go. When it comes to dealing with an enterprise or a place of prostitution, those were currently in our law, but they were found at a B and C felony level. We've moved them into the first degree level for the following reason. If you're going to be combating those individuals that are engaged in forcing others or causing others to be involved in sex trafficking, it's not just the recruitment of those people, that's in the second degree, but we're dealing with an enterprise. That's when somebody is managing or controlling an enterprise, an organization that's two or more people involved in this sort of conduct. That's why that's grouped there, because we're looking at those people that are forcing individuals to engage in this or those people that are trying to truly profit from it by running an enterprise or a place of prostitution. Now, one thing I would want to note about a place of prostitution, in my review of the bill and in preparing for today's testimony, I recognized that the definition of a place of prostitution wasn't quite as what we had originally hoped, and I have to take the responsibility for that. I'm the one that had signed off on this coming to you all too early. But that is something that we'd like to work with the committee and others on to ensure that what we really talk about for a place of prostitution is not where an individual is using their own apartment for themselves, but rather where they are allowing a place that they own or lease for somebody else to use it. It's not about when they are engaged in this conduct for themselves. What sex trafficking is all about is when you are encouraging or enticing or helping others to engage in the activity. And so that's an adjustment to the definition that we'll need to make, and I look forward to working with the committee on that.
And Mr. Skidmore, do you have recommended language to revise that definition?
We're working on that. As I indicated, this was something that I realized today, and I've come up with some ideas, but never are the ideas that are mine just offered to you all. It runs through a group of individuals, and we will be providing that in the next day or so, hopefully.
Okay. Please proceed.
The second part of Section 2 deals with sex trafficking in the second degree, and what this really focuses on is those individuals that are recruiting, enticing, inducing, or causing somebody to engage in sex trafficking with the intent to promote it. Sex trafficking in the third degree then focuses on those people that are facilitators, where they're providing services, resources, or other assistance. And it's broken up so that at the B felony level, it's when the services, resources, or other assistance is greater than $200, and it's a C felony when it's less than $200. You ask, why $200? Well, there's really two reasons for that. First, when we were looking at the statutes and we were looking at other states, the state we modeled that particular provision off of was New Jersey, and they used $200, so we thought, okay, we'll follow what they've done. But more than that, if you think about it, it also makes sense in this way. If you think about someone that is facilitating, that is helping with travel or arranging sex trafficking, if you think about the cost to move from community to community in Alaska, unless it's the Matsu to Anchorage, almost to get from any other community to community is going to be more than $200, which is really our analysis behind that. If you are causing somebody to engage in sex trafficking and you are facilitating the movement of that person that's the victim from one community to another, or you're attracting patrons from another community, that starts to become more significant than somebody that's staying in their own community because it's harder to track. It's the sort of thing that's more of a concealment nature. And so that's why we chose that $200 level, because that really makes sense when you think about trying to get from Anchorage to Juneau, or Anchorage to Fairbanks, or Anchorage to Bethel, or Bethel to Fairbanks, or Bethel, you get the idea, from one community to another in the state. That's really what we were looking at, and that's why we drew the distinction there. The last thing that Section 2 does is it goes after something that is really best practices throughout the country, and that's trying to focus not just on the supply side, but on the demand side. This is a problem that has to be attacked not just by going after those individuals that are forcing others into this lifestyle, but we also have to go after those individuals that are offering to pay to have sex with people that didn't really want to be engaged in that activity to begin with. This patron of a victim of sex trafficking is not somebody that is a patron of a prostitute. That's still in the prostitution statute, which is 1166-100. What we talk about as a patron is somebody that is a patron of a victim of sex trafficking. And that's very specifically defined in the bill as somebody that's under the age of 18 or that is obvious to that individual is a victim for some other reason. And we go through and provide definitions to help explain exactly what that would be. But that's what happens with the patron of sex trafficking. And once again, that's split between a B and a C felony level. And that's based upon the age of the victim. Under the age of 18, it's the B felony. Over the age of 18, it would be the C felony. And that's consistent, actually, with what used to be in statute for someone that was a patron of a prostitute under the age of, I think it's 18 as well, that it was also a felony in current law right now. So this just adjusts and shifts some of this to a different location, but calls out a victim of sex trafficking and differentiates that between simple prostitution. That's a long explanation, but that's a long section in Section 2. Section 3, then, of the bill addresses human trafficking, otherwise labor trafficking, or we include adult entertainment. Under current law, human trafficking also includes sexual conduct. We eliminated that from the human trafficking statutes because we believe that's appropriate in the sex trafficking statutes, not the human trafficking statutes. But other than that, what we do with the human trafficking statutes, aside from increasing the classifications to ensure that the penalties are appropriate, is we try and have it complement the sex trafficking statutes. So that first degree level deals with someone that is causing another person to engage in labor trafficking or human trafficking through the use of force or the threat of it when the victim is under the age of 20. That's really what the first degree deals with. The second degree deals with those individuals that are intending to promote through the recruitment, enticement, inducing or causing, same thing as sex trafficking in the second, only this one focuses on labor. And more importantly, in this particular section, we go through and we define some of the ways in which that can actually occur. So if you go through the subsections that are added there, you'll see the first one deals with confidential information. The next one deals with disclosing confidential information for devious purposes. You have passports or immigration documents or ID documents that are withheld or threatened to be withheld. You have the threat to make a report of an arrest or deportation with the purpose of promoting human trafficking. You have the collection of an unlawful debt, the withholding of food, clothing, lodging, medication, the providing or withholding of controlled substances, or through the use of deception. So we went through and outlined all those different ways. Once again, that's language that's drawn from other states in the way that they approach describing these things. And that greater delineation or definition of how you can be promoting was something that we found helpful both for law enforcement and for the public to understand what would actually be a violation. Human trafficking in the third degree then also mirrors the sex trafficking in that it talks about the facilitators through the use of services, resources, or other assistance. And once again, that's broken up between that $200 level between a B and a C felony. So that takes us to that's sections 3 through 7 for human trafficking. Then I move on to section 8, which is really just the definition section. And here we define various things such as adult entertainment, a commercial sex conduct, a phrase used throughout, place of prostitution. This is where I mentioned that we need to change that definition of place, a prostitution enterprise, services, resources, or other assistance. That's the phrase that we use for the facilitators in the third degree. It's actually defined here in statute, so you know exactly what it means. Sexual conduct is also defined. Sexual contact, sexual penetration, and the victim of sex trafficking. All of those different terms that are used throughout these statutes are placed in definitions there for folks. Then section 9 really just goes to the crime of coercion, which is also an 1141 crime. And in the criminal law, what happens is if you have two crimes that cover the same conduct and one crime is at a lower level than the other, then what the rule of lenity, that's a phrase, a term of art that's used in the criminal law that says you have to go with the lower penalty or the lower crime, is the one that controls. And so in this case, we didn't want coercion to be the exact same thing that's found for human trafficking or sex trafficking. And so we've just modified coercion to indicate it's still on the books for conduct other than what is described in these statutes. So that's really what we would consider to be a conforming amendment in order to apply appropriately for the statutes. Section 10 really then cleans up the statute related to prostitution in order to conform to the new statute numbers. You'll notice on the page where it actually makes an amendment, it's just changing the statute number for sex trafficking, again, moving it from 1166 to the 1141. The other thing it does is it also eliminates sex trafficking in the fourth degree because we've eliminated a fourth degree. We just have the first through 1 through 3 degrees. We then move on to section 11. This is also a conforming amendment for addressing the patron of a prostitute for somebody under the age of 18. Again, we created a new crime that's for the sex trafficking victims, so you don't need this in the prostitution statute any longer. Section 12 is the definition of sexual conduct. We're just clarifying that the definition of sexual conduct is the same for both prostitution and sex trafficking, and we indicate where the definition can be found in 1141. Sections 13 through 19, these are all conforming amendments. So sex trafficking is mentioned in various statutes throughout our books, and where it is, we need to ensure that the statutes remain consistent with the changes that would be made. If this bill were to be adopted into law, because we've moved sex trafficking to another location, we just need to ensure that it's referencing things appropriately. So for instance, section 15 deals with the statute of limitations, section 16 talks about commercial intercepts, section 17 is talking about fines, section 18 talks about suspended entry of judgments, and section 19 is suspended imposition of sentences. But in each one of those statutes, all we're doing is indicating where you can appropriately find the crimes now. None of those are policy decisions. It's all just changing language to be conforming. I'm going to move on to section 20. This is where we actually are making substantive changes. I talked about changing the classification for human trafficking. Currently, human trafficking is a lower level crime. We've elevated it to be an unclassified felony because we believe it's of that nature and that level. This is consistent with how sex trafficking in the first degree is classified, but there's a difference when it comes to sentencing for the two. Human trafficking is left as a regular or typical unclassified felony. The sex trafficking offenses, with the exception of one subsection under current law, were not classified as sex offenses. Let me say that again. Sex trafficking under current law is not considered a sex offense for purposes of sentencing. In our sentencing statutes, 1255-125, it lays out all of the different ranges for sentencing conduct. And subsection I is the subsection that deals with sex offenses. So what you find in section 21 is that we've placed all of the sex trafficking offenses in subsection I to ensure that they have those enhanced penalties. But for human trafficking, it's not a sex crime, and so it's left simply in the regular classifications. But we did increase the level of sex trafficking in the first degree, which is what section 20 does. It simply places it into that statute to indicate what the sentencing range would be for it now. I've talked about section 21. We've placed the various provisions of sex trafficking into the sex trafficking section for sentencing. That's all of what 21 does. Then I move on to sections 22 and 23. And these, and actually 24, all of these, again, are those conforming type of changes where because we've moved the location of sex trafficking, we have to amend that throughout the statute. So I know the bill seems like it's long because of the number of pages, but when you actually look at it, there's only a very few sections that make substantive changes. The vast majority of the pages in the bill is just conforming changes to other statutes that mention sex trafficking. Section 25 deals with the registration for sex offenses. Now, a moment ago, I told you that sex trafficking offenses in current law are not considered sex offenses for purposes of sentencing, nor did most of the sex trafficking offenses require sex offender registration. We have now classified them as sex offenses, adding them to subsection I, as well as in section 25, we add them to the list of offenses that one is required to register for as sex offenses. Section 26, this is a significant substantive addition. One of the things that we heard when we went around and talked with various folks like Covenant House and Priceless and the Alaska Native Justice Center, all of these individuals that are working with victims of sex trafficking said to us, why is it that a person who is convicted of prostitution at the time that they were a victim of sex trafficking, why are we holding them criminally accountable for that and punishing them with this conviction and all of the other consequences that flow from having a conviction if this was truly something that wasn't of their own volition and not something that they were choosing to engage in, but something that they had been coerced or forced into doing? That makes a lot of sense. And so what Section 26 does is it creates a procedure, a method by which an individual who has been convicted of prostitution to come forward and request that that prostitution conviction be vacated because they had been a victim of sex trafficking. That
Skidmore, is there a provision, that vacation provision of prostitution convictions, that exists in other states that you know
yes.
of?
There are other states that have approached this in a couple of different ways. Some states have provisions in which those convictions can be removed. There are some other states that have gone even further and actually created a provision that says someone that's under the age of, say, 18 can't even be convicted for prostitution at all. That's a concept that we've just today I was talking about with a member from Covenant House, and something that we're looking at is that the sort of thing that we could do in this bill or not? And what I would say overall is that our approach to this has been to try and collaborate and talk with lots of other folks in the communities. the bill now being in front of you all is our opportunity to also talk with you all and collaborate with you all. So if there are ideas that you all have or things that you wanted to pursue, I've come around to many of your offices already. I think the only office I hadn't been able to get to, unfortunately, the meeting we had with you, Mr. Chairman, we weren't able to make. So I'm looking forward to that opportunity still to do that. But if folks have ideas or concepts that they're interested in, I welcome that opportunity so that we can talk about those and look for what's the right way to go about it. And as I said, that's a conversation I was just having today with some folks from Covenant House. So to answer your question directly, yes, there are other states that allow for the vacation of the conviction, but there are also other states that go even further and say for individuals under the age of 18, we're just going to, as a matter of course, say that person will not be convicted of prostitution, but instead we're going to have them in some sort of protective hold for a certain period of time and then refer them to resources to try and get them out of that lifestyle. Because I think there's a common accepted notion that there is no little girl who grows up and says, gee, I'd really like to engage in prostitution when I get older. There's no little boy that grows up and says, I'd really like to engage in prostitution when I get older. That's not something that people aspire to generally. And so folks that are under the age of 18 that are engaged in that lifestyle, there clearly has to be concerns about why they're in that lifestyle. And it suggests that there are other things that they need to help them. And we as a state ought to find ways to do those things. Unless there are other questions about Section 26, I was going to move on.
Quick question.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way you just described that, Mr. Skidmore, nobody wants to grow up to be a prostitute. I'm not going to argue that this bill, and this is something I would certainly want to meet with you again on more, deals with sex trafficking.
Yes.
And not, and it should deal with the trafficker and the, yep. the John in the case, the patron.
Yep.
Why are we still, in this case, defining these victims as, and from what I can understand, a Class B misdemeanor as a criminal still?
So through the chair, Representative Hopkins, there are two concepts that you have to keep in mind simultaneously. One is sex trafficking is something that can victimize anyone of any age. It's not just juveniles. It's not just minors. It Absolutely. Can also be adults. And so the vacation, the Section 26 says that it's not just a minor that can apply for the conviction to be removed, but it says anyone that is a victim can have that be removed. But in response to the chair's question, how do other states approach that? One of the focuses in many other states is to focus on minors. And actually, the federal law also does this to say that anyone under the age of 18 is automatically considered a victim of sex trafficking. Period. End of story. Everyone under the age of 18 is considered in that manner. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to achieve. And so as I talk about those best practices and I talk about not convicting somebody under the age of 18, that's what we're talking about. If you're over the age of 18 and you engage in prostitution, you weren't forced into it, but you're just engaged in prostitution, that remains a Class B misdemeanor, up to, you know, 0 to 90 days in jail, nothing more than that. But for folks that are trafficked, then we're still going after the traffickers, and we still want to provide those adults a way to say, hey, wait a minute, I was truly just a victim here, and I shouldn't have that conviction on my record.
Follow up. Thank you. Again, so in the governor's letter, if that's directly following this bill in our bill packet, last sentence on the first page, the threat of being charged with a crime is often a tactic that traffickers will use to continue to control their victims, I guess. Then the last sentence. It is important for society to recognize that these victims have no other choice and they should not be treated as criminals when they are, in fact, victims of themselves. Yet here we are criminalizing all of them who are trafficked, the victims of this crime, of trafficking, and then requiring them to go provide this burden of proof on their own accord to get this vacated. If we catch the trafficker and he's got a ship full of people coming over from Southeast Asia or somewhere where they might be bringing them from or anywhere, we're expecting those people to go through our court system and find all these the evidence that they're going to need to put forward, or a 20-year-old who's been sex trafficked for the last 10 years of her life or his life, and all of a sudden they have to find the wherewithal to go to court, have the burden of proof, to have this vacated. Why are we not able in this bill to say we caught the trafficker with a truckload of victims, literally a truckload of victims, and all those victims are now criminals? Why are we not able to say all of you are able to not have to go to court? Why are we not able to draw that line?
So through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I apologize. I misunderstood the question. That is a line that you would be able to draw. My response would be individuals in those circumstances would not be prosecuted for prostitution. We wouldn't go after them for that purpose. We would be talking with them and working with them and getting them to cooperate with us in terms of presenting that prosecution case if at all possible. But we would have no interest in prosecuting those people in that circumstance. And your question is, could the legislature make the law specific so that we wouldn't be able to do that? And the answer is yes, you could.
Follow up again.
Follow up.
So I'd be able to work with you to, and I'm not a lawyer. My wife is. I am not. She comes up a lot in committee today. But why was that not the initial approach in this bill, with that as one of the governor's main rationales for this bill, which I totally support, and he is absolutely correct, and I agree with him 100%. Why was that not the initial approach that you took in writing this bill?
The approach that we took was to try and correct past harms that occurred. And that's why we talked about the vacation. Because what you describe is saying you can't prosecute for somebody, that doesn't do anything for the people that have already been prosecuted. So that's what we focused on first, is how do we help them clean that portion up? And then, quite frankly, it's probably just a prosecutor's perspective of, I'm not worried about that other part because we know that's not going to happen. That's not something that we're going to pursue. That's not a case that we're going to prosecute. I know that from doing the job that I do. But I recognize from your standpoint, you're asking, can we as the legislature create a law that would say prosecutors don't even have to ask themselves that question because we're going to say it shouldn't happen? And my answer is yes, you could do that.
A quick follow-up. Again, not a law, but a section in this law as we are working
Correct.
It through.
Correct.
Okay, I'll work with Les Legal and you on that one, because that is something very, very important to me, that we are doing everything we can
Sure.
to not criminalize the victims and the sex workers in this bill. And thank you. For working with me on that in the future.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand fully the conversation here. Is one of the distinctions in the language, because there are people who choose prostitution, and then there are people who are clearly victims who are not making that choice, and so there would need to be a distinction made rather than us having legislation that says everyone's a victim? Is that the reasoning of the wording as it is presented?
So through the chair, Representative Vance, what you were describing is, how would we differentiate between those that are victims and those that are not? And that's a great question. That's the sort of issue that would have to be tackled, and I don't know what ideas the Representative Hopkins may have for those things, but I'm happy to talk about those things. I'm happy to look at those things, but you're absolutely correct that the challenge will be, how do you differentiate and who's going to make that determination? Is that going to be a prosecutor that says, nope, this person's not a victim, or yes, this person is the victim, or is that supposed to be the courts that are making that determination? So those are the sorts of issues we would have to work through. I can tell you that other states that have looked at it say that they do not, what I've seen in the states that I've looked at, they focus on minors. I don't know that I've seen a provision that also addresses adults, though it may be there and I just haven't seen it yet. So, but that distinction is something that we would have to work through. How do you make the distinction? Who makes the distinction?
I'm going to suggest maybe if and when we have language to consider, we really drill into that. Yeah. Mr. Skidmore, I think we were in the section, somewhere in the section 30s.
Section 27 is where we left off.
Oh, never mind. Okay, right before.
And what that does is it says that victims of sex trafficking are one of the types of crimes, the victims that are eligible for compensation for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. That's section 27. They're added to that. Sections 28 and 29 are conforming amendments. Licenses for school bus drivers. Again, if you're convicted of sex trafficking, that's makes you ineligible to get a license as a school bus driver. And section 29 is the Landlord-Tenant Act. It's just amending the definition there to reference the appropriate location and statute for the crimes. Section 30 deals with PFDs, and indicating that if someone has a conviction vacated and that conviction had caused them to be ineligible for a PFD in that year or a subsequent year, they would now be entitled to receive that PFD for the year that they had been ineligible at whatever amount it had been awarded in that year. It's just, again, trying to go back and say these were people that had some sort of negative consequence and the collateral consequences associated with it and trying to rectify those things. So that's Section 30. Sections 31 through 34 are all conforming language, as I had mentioned earlier. It's about the changing the location of the statutes. Section 35 is the repealer section. This goes through and repeals, for example, sex trafficking in the first, second, third, and fourth as it's currently in statute because we're placing them in another location. We move some other statutes around as well related to not needing to have corroborating evidence, forfeiture, definitions. Those things are deleted for those reasons. Section 36 then is the applicability section, and it indicates obviously when the bill would be applicable to offenses occurring at what time frame. And finally, Section 37 is the effective date, which says that the bill would become effective on the 1st of July of 2020. So that's the sectional overall. And I know that there were a couple of folks online, I think, from the Department of Public Safety, if you all had questions for them. And I think there may have been some other folks that were invited for testimony as well. So unless there's any other questions for me, I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Online, Mike Ingram from AST, and then Samantha, which I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Shiro, the new PD.
Yes.
Yeah, our new PD. Also available for questions. And then Catherine Monfreda from DPS. Questions from the committee? Representative Hopkins?
Yeah, thank you. This is a question Mr. Skidmore might have been able to answer it, but I'll ask Ms. Shiro as the public defender. Thank you for being online, ma'am. Again, the way the bill is written right now in Section 26 that Mr. Skidmore and I were just discussing, where the victim is working to vacate the crime of misdemeanor B as a for prostitution, would that person have access to a public defender in this case to help them through that process, or would they be on their own or required to pay an attorney out of their own pocket?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Hopkins. My interpretation of this as the bill is written is that there wouldn't be a mechanism for them to have appointed counsel in that type of situation.
Thank you very much.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Yes, and I'm not sure if the public defender can answer this or not, or if it's a victim's advocacy group, but I have heard that many people in prostitution, that it is not a choice, even though one would think it's a choice at some point. I'd like to hear some people with the background and more knowledge in that than I am. And why I say that is partly it's the way our economic system is set up. And if you have a family and you're trying to provide for them and you're of limited income, anyway, I've just heard information on that before. That was very thought-provoking, and I don't know if anyone has some information about that, more information.
I have opinions, but no information.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Skidmore, for the presentation, and we'll set the bill aside. That concludes the three items on today's agenda. Thank you, Martha and Madison, for facilitating today's meeting. We're up next Tuesday, February 25th, and at 4:42, we're adjourned.